Welcome back to the U.S. Naval History Podcast. This is one of the best episodes that I have released yet. I'm talking with Rear Admiral Mike Studeman, the commander of the Office of Naval Intelligence and the director of the National Maritime Intelligence Integration Office. We talk about China's grand plans for the South China Sea, a few of the aggressive actions China has undertaken recently in the South China Sea, Xi Jinping and the psychology of authoritarian states, how the Chinese military may have been the tail wagging the dog in China's recent border skirmishes with India, who would and would not side with the United States in a fight over Taiwan, the consequences for China if they do invade Taiwan, and a whole lot more. This is an amazing conversation, which I think gets better and better as we get deeper into it, and I hope that you really enjoy this episode. So without further ado. So sometimes it's nice when the world works out with your podcast release schedule. This is from NBC News on July 3rd.
Tonight, new video showing the moments a Chinese warship, seen on the left here, came within 150 yards of an American destroyer in the Taiwan Strait. The near collision with the USS Chunghoon is the latest example of possible aggression from the Chinese military. The incident comes just days after a Chinese fighter jet flew directly in front of a U.S. Air Force aircraft in what the Pentagon called an unnecessarily aggressive maneuver.
China appears to be extremely non-conciliatory at the annual very high-profile International Shangri-La Dialogue Security Forum held in Singapore. General Li Shangfu, who is China's new defense minister, addressed the incident the next day in a speech by warning Western militaries to stay out of waters and airspace near China's borders if they wanted to avoid dangerous run-ins with the People's Liberation Army.
We have codes for encounters at sea and in air reached with many other countries to prevent unnecessary dangers. But I want to also raise a question. The incidents you mentioned, why did all those incidents happen in areas near China? To truly prevent such incidents in the future, we not only need the codes, the best way is for all the countries, especially the naval vessels and fighter jets, all countries, not to do closing actions around other countries' territories. What's the point going there? For China, we always say, mind your own business. If that is the case, then I don't think there will be future problems. Thank you.
Li spoke a day after U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and Canadian Defense Minister Anita Anand used their speeches at the forum to criticize China for dangerous incidents in the air. Here's Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin.
We will continue to stand by our allies and partners as they uphold their rights. We will maintain our vigorous responsible presence across the Indo-Pacific. And we'll continue to work to ensure that no one country can assert control over shared waterways. In the South China Sea, we will continue to work with our allies and partners to uphold the freedom of navigation and overflight. And let me again underscore the importance of the 2016 ruling by the Arbitral Tribunal. It is legally binding and it is final. We won't be deterred by dangerous operational behavior at sea or in international airspace. The People's Republic of China continues to conduct an alarming number of risky intercepts of U.S. and allied aircraft flying lawfully in international airspace. We've all just seen another troubling case of aggressive and unprofessional flying by the PRC. So we will support our allies and partners as they defend themselves against coercion and bullying. To be clear, we do not seek conflict or confrontation, but we will not flinch in the face of bullying or coercion.
In her speech, Canadian Defense Minister Anand called out China's similar interceptions of Canadian military aircraft, monitoring the implementation of UN sanctions against North Korea, and called China an, quote, increasingly disruptive global force that increasingly disregards international rules and norms. The Shangri-La Dialogues are a very well-established, Pacific-focused diplomatic forum for major players in the region to come together and talk. But this year, the attitude was pretty frosty. The Chinese Defense Minister Li said that he met with defense leaders from 11 countries in Singapore, but broke with the tradition of U.S.-China dialogue at the forum by refusing to speak with Secretary Austin. And all of this sets the stage for the fourth and final part of the U.S. Naval History Podcast South China Sea miniseries. In this episode, we are going to focus on the history of Chinese aggression in the South China Sea, including some of the most notorious incidents over the past 20 years, of which the one that we heard at the top of the show is just scratching the surface. And with me to discuss this is one of, if not the most qualified people in the entire world, Admiral Mike Sudeman, the commander of the Office of Naval Intelligence and the director of the National Maritime Intelligence Integration Office. Welcome, sir.
Hey, Chase, thanks for this. I look forward to your questions. These are really important topics, and we need to keep a level head and truly understand what's going on to prevent, you know, miscalculation and make the right policy choices and the right choices for the military instrument. So I look forward to delving deeper.
Excellent. Let's start then. So what is China's long-term plan for the South China Sea?
Well, they claim, based on historic rights, it's all theirs. Their nine dash line, some people say 10 or 11, depending on the dashes that go up on the east side of Taiwan. But essentially, they claim these broad areas and think that it's their own territory. They will send ships down there to the very southern regions of the South China Sea at St. James Shoal, and they will do commissioning ceremonies, kind of like, you know, crossing the line ceremonies for us. But for them, this is like, hey, I am re-enlisting or commissioning or whatever at the southernmost point of China's sovereign. Those arguments were rejected by the UN tribunal that considered China's claims when the Philippines submitted a complaint. And so the international community, as represented by the tribunal, essentially said, you're getting it wrong. Your historic rights were extinguished when you signed on with UNCLOS, which had parameters and definitions for what individual states have the rights to claim. And that's how we got to our designation of territorial waters, a continuous zone. And so China is a very disruptive force in trying to essentially re-adjudicate and reinterpret what UNCLOS stands for.
And so what do they want? Do they want all economic rights? Do they want to kick everybody out? Do they want to set up military bases? What is their dream South China Sea scenario?
Well, they've already set up military bases.
Correct.
They already moved out on building up the Paracel Island. So Woody Island is a classically referenced place in the Paracels where you see aircraft doing patrols, but also has a harbor and other support facilities. And then they built these massive places with reclamation like the world hasn't seen in the Spratlys. And they have a number of strong points down there with all sorts of equipment. So you're talking about surface-to-air missiles, coastal defense cruise missiles, electronic warfare capability, long runways. You have jammers that are down there, even have directed energy weapons that are down there. Command and control sites, radar sites, they're bristling with military capability. China's tried to creep along and not let a lot of people know about it. And that's the way they do business. This gradualism where, you know, they don't do anything shocking in a short amount of time. Hopefully they get everybody accustomed to their presence. Their view is that they will get de facto effective control over the South China Sea by dint of the number of Coast Guard vessels they have. It's the largest Coast Guard force in the world and the largest Navy. They are the largest Navy in the world. And through things like maritime militia, ex-PLA guys that go out there, you know, with steel reinforced bows and communications equipment and pretend fishing gear to be able to try to essentially not only have the eyes and ears that they want, but to harass and intimidate other claimants and try to get effective control. The latest incident, not in the South China Sea per se, because the southern part of the Taiwan Straits doesn't count as that, but when the Luoyang cut across the Chenghu's bow, leaving only 150 feet of separation, that's pretty dangerous stuff, right?
Right. I mean, that's unbelievably dangerous. When I saw the video, I was not good. And in episode 2 of the South China Sea miniseries, I do talk a lot about the maritime militia. And if anyone listening has not heard that, I would encourage you to go back and listen to that. But since China has militarized, you know, a number of reefs and rocks and other features in the South China Sea, what is the end game that the U.S. should realistically aim for in the South China Sea? And I say realistically in that saying that China should suddenly recognize everyone's sovereign rights and abide by the law of the sea and, you know, recognize the 2016 ruling, which arbitrated against them, and abandon Fiery Cross Reef, et cetera. There's no real chance of that. So what is the realistic end game that the U.S. should aim for?
Yeah, I think that we need to support our Southeast Asian partners in ensuring that there aren't extraterritorial gains for which they can't defend their own rights against, right? And so what does that come down to? In some ways, that's sensing, and that's information sharing about what's actually happening, because, you know, it's not like there's like a persistent stare in Southeast Asia where every rim country down there sees what's going on. And so we need to make sure we have more visibility, and we shine spotlights into areas where the Chinese would love to keep it dark and operate in the shadows, and that's where mushrooms grow. They love that. And so we need to not only get sensing so that we can see what's happening, but then that's shared rapidly so these coastal states can do, you know, what any coastal state with legitimate rights should do to protect their interests. And the Chinese are hoping that eventually everybody just sort of gets tired and says, okay, there's so much overwhelming force that, you know, the Chinese have de facto control and we might as well cede. That's what they hope. That's not what's going to happen. Every country there has actually, in one way or another, stiffened their spine and done more to defend their interests. Philippines is a classic example of that. Indonesia has been more worried about this red tide of Chinese mm-hmm. ships that go into, you know, their EEZs and territorial waters. And so there's been actually some significant teaming that some of these Southeast Asian nation states have done together. And they've talked about joint patrols, greater cooperation. And sometimes, you know, the United States doesn't have to be in on that. There's a set of bilaterals, trilaterals, multilaterals, where sometimes we have a role, sometimes we don't. But those are actually growing as a result of China's aggressiveness. The Chinese seem to be pretty tone deaf about the whole thing, but they keep pushing because, you know, that's what they think they need to do because Xi Jinping wants it.
So would you say that on the whole, the Chinese are getting more or less aggressive in the South China Sea?
No, clearly they're more aggressive. When we paint out, you know, examples on the air front, for example, last couple of years have seen a significant jump, not every flight, not every intercept, but you're talking about over 100 cases of very close intercepts with, you know, aircraft that are just off the wing, more cases of thumping, which is going fast right under an aircraft and then coming up and forcing that aircraft to undergo some pretty heavy turbulence. We're close to where we were in 2001 when Lieutenant Commander Wang Wei, whatever his name was, ended up hitting the EP3. It was straight and level in a normal zone. It had always been there, hadn't done anything unusual. And this hot dog of a guy wasn't a good enough pilot to stay safe, and ended up creating an international incident there with EP3 having to land on Hainan Island. We're like a, you know, hair trigger away from that kind of incident again. And the question is whether or not you know, the Chinese are comfortable with that amount of friction or that amount of danger. And I guess the answer is, if they keep doing it, they're willing to take these kind of risks.
Right. I mean, when you're moving at hundreds of miles an hour, and, you know, they've gotten within 100 feet and sometimes within 20 feet of our aircraft, miscalculation is extremely easy. And sort of we got a little bit of a taste of that back in March when two Russian Su-27s were doing some gas dumping runs on a Reaper drone flying over the Black Sea, and they accidentally hit it. And due to poor piloting on the Russians' part, the Reaper went down. And I think this sort of points out exactly what you're talking about when you are putting aircraft into dangerous situations. All it takes is one error, one poorly trained pilot, one guy who didn't get enough sleep to cause disaster. And so why are the Chinese doing this, if not to cause an accident?
Yeah, in their view, they see with a very paranoid lens that everything we do is to keep China's rise from happening, to suppress them, encircle them, keep them down, prevent China from getting its rightful place in the world. And so they have this sensitivity here to operations that are occurring in international airspace and waters, but near enough so they can, see that we're there monitoring. We haven't substantially changed, by the way, how we do airborne ISR in that region of the world. We had been sending for decades aircraft in the East China Sea and South China Sea and in other places. And we did that because that region had some pretty important developments and potential flashpoints that we needed to monitor. And the fact of the matter was that the Chinese built up this gigantic juggernaut of a war machine, and doing operations that were more coercive and more aggressive all the time, accompanied with, all sorts of rhetoric about taking Taiwan back and ensuring that China was going to protect its core sovereignty issues. And so you had this very violent strain of propaganda accompanied with this huge war machine doing coercive things. And our allies and partners are sitting right there. So we are monitoring the growth of the Chinese military, wondering, what are they doing with the military? How good are they? And when are they? Are they going to jump right away to attack an island or to do more things against the Vietnamese security forces? What about Japan, the Senkaku Islands? They're putting more Coast Guard ships in there trying to get de facto creeping control over the Senkakus. And everybody, all our allies out there, are extremely concerned. Mm-hmm. They are building back up their militaries and security forces. The Japanese are moving things in the Ryukyus because they're so fearful of what's going to happen. Everyone's on tenterhooks with regard to Taiwan and Chinese intentions there. And that kind of stuff requires you to be there to monitor it and to ensure that you're not going to end up missing a potential threat that would affect a partner and an ally. So that's the reason why we are there. And we're in international airspace and waterways. The Chinese claim near me or adjacent waters or all this other vague language to somehow pretend that where we're operating is their territory, and which is patently false. So anyway, there's a different view here about how things are developing. The Chinese think we're encircling. We take a look at it and go, we haven't changed much. It's you guys that are actually growing, and China is actually destabilizing, disruptive, and dangerous, and we're going to have to be there. And this affects how we think about the Taiwan issue, too. If you're Taiwan and you're looking at what happened with Hong Kong, you know there's no one country, two systems. Right. You can't trust the Chinese.
I mean, I think the takeover of Hong Kong was Xi Jinping giving up on the long-term hope of using Hong Kong as a model for Taiwan. Look, you can still retain a good number of rights and freedoms and semblance of democracy, et cetera, et cetera. And essentially that was, we no longer believe that will work.
It's important to understand how that went down, though, because the Hong Kong problem was Xi Jinping's problem. And I would tell you that the Chinese are the chief engineers of their own crises, right? Chinese are the chief engineers of their own crises. If you take a look, Xi Jinping comes in, he has a much more Machiavellian view of things. He wants to rush them towards a dream and a rejuvenation. He's not going to bide his time. He's not going to hide. You know, he's going to use Chinese power to solve all their problems and get their rightful place. And so with Hong Kong, you know, the 2014 umbrella protests were all about the Chinese trying to change the way the chief executive essentially was selected, right? Mm-hmm. You remember right. that?
Yeah,
deciding that, no, all the candidates had to be pre-approved by Beijing before they could even be considered for the chief executive. So the Hong Kong people saw that early on, like, we're starting to see, you know, a very clear attack against a democracy. It's clearly not, you know, giving Hong Kong the 50 years of autonomy that was promised in 1997 at the turnover. And when the Chinese wanted to get the national security law through and some other things that were, mm-hmm. were also attacks that would erode democracy, the Hong Kong people rose up. So when the Chinese, if you're in the Chinese narrative, they'll tell you, I had instability and I had the black hand of America making Hong Kong people push against and create this very volatile situation. When in fact, the Chinese were responsible for engineering changes to the political system in a way that resulted in legitimate protests, which then the Chinese used to justify a crackdown, which now essentially has extinguished democracy in Hong Kong. Right. This all started with decisions that were made under Xi Jinping.
Yeah, so, to an extent, that's shooting themselves in the foot. They have ceded Hong Kong as the regional hub to Singapore completely, and you know, they have provided a counterexample of what the Taiwanese, or many Taiwanese at least, do not want to happen. And you know, absolutely an engineer of their own crisis there. And so, you know, we were talking a little bit earlier about using the Coast Guard and the maritime militia. Is that mix changing? Are the Chinese starting to rely more on the Gray Hull Navy as opposed to the Coast Guard, or is it not? How do you see that changing in the near future, and how has it changed recently?
Yeah, no, so it's a three-layer kind of thing. So I think you're familiar that usually up close, you have the militia, and they're sometimes they do cabbage patch. So in other words, the surround, you know, mm-hmm. exploration rigs, or you know, they'll try to, you know, get close to, if the Philippines is trying to resupply Second Thomas Shoal, they'll come in, try to harass, and they'll radio calls, and they'll try to intimidate. The Chinese Coast Guard are right there, you know, within sight line, pretty close, but a second layer, I guess the way to describe it. And the third layer over the horizon is the PLA Navy. And they always have like a big shooter there to make it clear that if necessary, the PLA Navy can bring in, you know, a combatant two or three or whatever. And so this is par for the course. This is Chinese intimidation tactics designed to get these claimants to essentially shut up and color, and they won't. And they're going to continue to stand up for themselves. And the question is, under what conditions would the Chinese then consider using even more aggressive tactics? You'll notice one of the techniques that they use was to try to use, you know, their military grade lasers against the Philippine mm-hmm. by, you know, crews and things like that. Who knows where this goes? I mean, don't count out anything from, you know, a very aggressive foreign policy that Xi Jinping has put in place. It's very dangerous.
So, you know, talking about aggressive tactics, can you tell me about some of the worst incidents that the Chinese have been involved in the past, you know, decade or two since they've gotten really aggressive in the South China Sea?
Besides cutting off some of the ships that are there, and we've got pictures of some of their Chinese combatants also getting very close. It's reminiscent of what the Soviets would do in the Cold War, which forced us eventually, after years of, you know, bumping and crossing and, you know, and other kinds of activities to create the incidents at sea agreement. China would never sign one. They're supposed to follow coal regs and the code mm-hmm. for planned encounters at sea, you know, and unclosed and things like that. They're blowing off all that stuff whenever they think that they, you know, want to raise the risk of doing business to anybody in that region. So, you know, some of the most egregious things have been, well, sink in Vietnamese fishing vessels, you know, operating in areas where in any other part of the world, they would have rights to fish. They've also dumped chaff for fighters, dumped chaff into the intakes of Australian patrol aircraft deep in the southern and eastern parts of the South China Sea, far away from anything, you know, Chinese. They've done crazy tactics around Canadian patrol aircraft in the East China Sea, really, really dangerous stuff. You know, now they're, you know, they've done thumping and they're, you know, right off the shoulder and wing of many of our patrol aircraft. So look, this is their choice to try to raise the risk to us and try to get us to, you know, just leave them alone and back away. And so very irresponsible. And I think that if you were to rewind a little bit and say, well, how did they get here? Part of this is the Russia-China relationship. The Russians are very used to these kinds of tactics. We're pretty sure by inference that the Russians said, hey, why don't you do this? Whenever they're in the Black Sea, we run an Su-24 fencer, you know, 10 feet across, you know, the top of a bridge, you know, and we show them, you need to stand up for yourself. And you can see that conversation occurring where they're reviewing their tactics and techniques and saying, hey, China, you should do more of this. That they're not really going to push back. The Americans aren't going to push back, you know, and of course the risk calculation to be one which is an American choice. You can do this, China, go ahead. And so we think that that's probably what's taking place behind the scenes. And we're well aware that they are doing this with intent. These aren't individual fighter pilots or ship drivers. They are mixing it up as part of their policy. And I'll add one more thing. The Chinese have changed where they used to have some standoff and some consideration to say, every time I encounter a U.S. or an allied ship or aircraft, I might be able to get some training value out of this. And so I'm gonna test them out. I'm gonna see how they're gonna react. And if they react a certain way, I'll learn something about how they're gonna do business, and I'll maybe get some training out of it too. And so this Chinese approach has also changed the dynamics in terms of their willingness to really close in and do much more close proximity ops. It doesn't matter if you're in the West Philippine Sea, South China Sea, East China Sea. It's the same kind of approach. And so it's been a definite shift over the last couple of years.
So you're talking about intent earlier, and it's not, you know, Lieutenant whoever making the decision to take these tactics, but what level is approving, aware of, directing this policy? Is this, you know, sort of a Xi Jinping on down thing, or is this stopped somewhere in the Chinese Ministry of Defense? What level is this aggression policy coming from, if we do know that?
Yeah, I would say that Xi Jinping is accountable for all things that his PLA does. And so if you're a dictator, if you are an authoritarian leader of a totalitarian state, then you have ultimate responsibility for decisions. We know that Xi Jinping is somebody who wants to control, you know, almost everything in the party, in the state, in the military. He is the central, you know, military commission chairperson, right? Chairman. And so he has the responsibility, and he knows what's happening, and he sanctions it. And so it's very clear that the PLA will continue to do this so long as Xi Jinping and the Chinese don't pay a price.
Does the full and unvarnished truth make its way to Xi Jinping, in that it's been a historical weakness of dictatorships? We've seen again and again that the full and unvarnished truth, when it is bad news, tends not to, you know, or doesn't agree with what the dictator thinks, tends not to make it to him out of other people's personal safety concerns.
Yeah, you're exactly right. There are lots of cases where an event may have occurred and the PLA was slow or with half facts or, you know, some amount of covering up, you know, moved information up the chain. And so obviously, you know, these guys who are scared for their lives or for their careers are not going to just offer themselves up as, you know, the ones who made any kind of mistake. And so you get a little bit of whitewashing in some of the reportage. And that's what we're talking about. A dangerous government is one where they don't even know what happened themselves, but are just reacting to whatever warped information kind of came through the chain of command. And we're really concerned about what that means going forward. We know we will probably have the best gauge on what will happen, and they will probably have something of an adulterated view of what happened, and both sides will think that they are right. And this is how wars start, and this is how friction grows between states. If you can't have a way to talk to your state in question, then that problem will only exacerbate and get worse. And this is the reason why, you know, we've talked about hotlines and mill-to-mill discussions and things like that. Now, the Chinese think that if you do that, they think it's like a safety net, which would allow us to do anything we want. And then if we get in trouble, something happens, we'll just get our get out of jail free card by calling them up and saying, oops, I'm sorry. And so they're using that because they think that if they have it, then we'll be incentivized to cause trouble. And it's a warped view on the Chinese side. That's what they believe. And so what you got is more aggressive actions and less of an ability to resolve a crisis, you know, when one may erupt. And the chances of it erupting are much more likely than ever these days.
So given that this is a history podcast, back in World War II, there's very much, pre-World War II, I should say, there was a Japan-style situation in which the tail was to an extent wagging the dog, where the military was taking somewhat independent action, and the government at this point felt it could not go against the military's wishes, or the military might win that power, that internal power struggle. And so as a result, government policy had to adapt to what the military was doing. And there's been a widely reported, at least, right, that Xi Jinping has clamped down on a lot of the independent power of the military and centralized a lot of power under himself. And so is that problem remote, or is that still a historical parallel that has some amount of learning that can be taken from it, do you think?
Well, let me just throw a few thoughts out there for you. First of all, it's very clear that loyalty matters more than anything in that kind of regime. That if you are over executing, you're good. If you are under executing, you're not good. And so what this creates is sort of a rabid, almost uber aggressive approach to fulfilling sort of the mandates and mission and rejuvenation goals of your dear leader. And I think that's what we saw on the Western border. I'm not sure that Xi Jinping
wanted to have... In India, you're talking about?
Yeah, on the line of actual control with India. I don't think Xi Jinping actually consciously said, okay, guys, let's go ahead and start taking territory on that line of actual control, and we're just going to push through no matter what the reaction is. That's what the Western Military Region Commander probably did, because he wanted to have something in his fitness report or to show how loyal he was, and he was going to get things done and stand up for the Chinese and be a wolf warrior.
Yes.
The Western side. And I think that Xi Jinping looked at that and said, oh my gosh, what was that? Oh, I think I need to own that now. I need to support my guy who is wolf warriorish and say, what? That's really good. It's protecting the sovereignty. And so I think the tail wagged the dog on that issue. And when you think about it, it's like the height of geopolitical incompetence, right?
Like, do you really want to
start something over a few kilometers of barren terrain in the high mountains there for a alteration of your strategic relationship and partnership with India, such that they are now turning away from China and towards the United States and the West in a way we have never seen since the independence of India, right?
Yeah,
I mean, who do you think actually was behind that? The military and these commanders who were over executing, or you think they dreamed that up somewhere, you know, in the Politburo? And I think it's the former, not the latter.
No, that's an excellent point. I think that's that sounds entirely plausible to me, and you would know better than I. So, going to Taiwan, where, you know, sort of part of the Chinese, the 9-dash lines weren't enough. They revised it to the 10 and 11-dash lines to include Taiwan. They sort of forgot about that when they were forging or making the original fake map back in the 30s. What are the range of possibilities? What happens in a scenario in which the Chinese, for example, they might detect a credible threat of terrorist activity, right? And so therefore they impose some sort of inspection regime at sea, which slows trade enough to effectively be a blockade, but yeah, it's not a blockade, it's an inspection regime, so it's not an act of war. You know, but of course, if the PRC inspectors were just allowed to inspect at the port, then I'm sure that there'd be no need to do this inspection at sea, right? So what, and the Chinese become serious about it, what are the range of possibilities that happen here? No one shoots first sort of scenario.
Over Taiwan, you mean? So
correct. Yeah.
There are any number of different scenarios or dreamed up pretexts that the Chinese could put in play. So you state this one, but there are a lot that have been considered. And so you can expect that the Chinese information machine will certainly have an excuse or blame somebody else for what they may initiate. That's just the way that works. If they're intending to do something, they want the information dominance to suggest that they had to react, that it was in defense of the nation, and all the rest. And so anyway, it doesn't matter which scenario you're talking about. And we worry about some of those things with regard to a justification that they may have for taking a small island. And if you, I would tell you that we're in a very decisive decade. It is a very dangerous decade. You have this strong PLA that wants to prove itself. You've got these ambitions to take back territory, to solve big problems like Taiwan. And she wants to be even more impressive in the pantheon of Chinese gods than Mao Zedong. And he's getting older, so he's got to accomplish these things probably in the next, you know, 10 to 15 years or something. So you have all of these things kind of conspiring and an impatience, a strategic impatience that may lead him to do some of these actions there against Taiwan. In the near term, before 2027, it would probably be something like a small island invasion or some other, you know, small thing that they can control. But after 2027, when they have nuclear strength where they want it, you know, and other capabilities where they want it to guarantee them, you know, a slam dunk win, no matter what scenario over Taiwan, the temptation will grow for them to consider something, you know, more significant, particularly if nothing in their coercion campaign has worked to be able to get Taiwan to come to the table and talk about, you know, unification or something like that. So we are in a very, very dangerous time, and the misperceiving and the evaluation of the correlation of military forces and how Taiwan plays, you know, its part here all matter in terms of what happens with that flashpoint. The likelihood of us getting into crisis is higher almost with every passing month.
So there's the famous Davidson window set by Admiral Phil Davidson, who back in 2021 said that he thought China might seek to achieve its ambitions with respect to integrating Taiwan to the mainland within the next 6 years. So that put it at 2027. Do you have a Sudeman window?
Well, listen, I was supporting Admiral Davidson at the time and some other, so you wouldn't be surprised to know that I would align with that view that there's no iron countdown to 2027. It's just get ready by. But that after 2027 and in succeeding years, you may find the Chinese have the confidence, the will, and the desire to potentially do something more extreme. The potential for them to miscalculate is huge here. And they, I don't think, understand that there would not be a quick war, a thing that would simply be over in 10 days or whatever. This would be potentially something that would lead to a major power war with nuclear elements associated with it. And I think it's our jobs as policymakers and people who advise policymakers on the intelligence side to devise the best policies that get to a prevention strategy and keep the peace while still kind of managing this problem. We've been able to kick the can down the road and maintain status quo for a long time on this. And ideally, we continue to do so. The conditions are just not right for resolution. In the end, if you do have a violent attempt to resolve the problem, you'll end up casting that region into chaos. And the effect on the global economy would be massive. And it could end up changing many things, including the course of China's future in a way that would not benefit that regime. That's why we call it very dangerous times.
So the concept of a near-term conflict raises the question of trade-offs between investments in the short term and investments that pay off, you know, 2030s and beyond. And so do the Chinese see a temporal gap? Would it be bad for the U.S. to magically invest an extra $100 billion a year in the Navy because all of a sudden it creates some sort of temporal impetus for war when the spending was authorized versus when it pays off? And sort of one of the comparisons I'm mentally making is the 1940 Big Navy Act, which sort of injected the equivalent of $200 billion one-year bump, which made sure that we had all the carriers we needed during World War II, but it also kicked off, plausibly kicked off World War II sooner than it would have, for us at least.
Now, let me throw some things in to just take you down your line of thought. You know, nothing operates fast. You can throw $100 billion in today. What are you going to get for it? It's not going to magically appear. You know, our industrial base is only so quick. It takes years to build up something as a result of that money. So, look, your decisions 5 and 10 years ago were the most significant decisions that we were making about the force in the 20s. You can spend some of that. You need some, expenditures in key areas and long-range fires and sensing and other capabilities, certain munitions and space capabilities and all the rest. So that money would go to good use. So that may be part of the solution, so long as you factor in the temporal delays. But really what we're looking at is a multi-part play. And people want to turn this into a dialectic between China and the United States. Hey, what about Taiwan? They're right in the middle. And when we talk about our foreign military sales or other support, it's designed as completely reflective of the Chinese threat. If the threat weren't as big, we wouldn't have to give as much in terms of foreign military sales. It's a direct reaction to China's aggressiveness and the threat that they pose. But that's actually where we need to spend a lot of quality time, and we are, to make sure that Taiwan can defend itself as the Taiwan Relations Act requires of us. And so what we help the Taiwanese create in terms of their own deterrence is really important. They're there every day. They need to be able to defend themselves. They need to be able to ensure that this political situation is not resolved through force.
Got a few somewhat rapid fire yes, no questions. And in a Taiwan showdown, I would say the middle of the road Taiwan showdown, which turns hot, in a yes, no scenario, would Japan support us?
I believe that of course is not known, but I also believe that it's more likely yes under certain conditions.
Would Australia?
Depends what the Prime Minister wants to do, but I believe that the Australians would be very supportive of the blue side on this.
Would all of NATO, if it involved a significant strike on the United States? United States military assets.
Are you thinking whether or not that would trip Article 5?
Would it trip it, and would nations respond meaningfully?
I don't think NATO would be involved in a fight over Taiwan with China. I think there would be moral support. I think there would be maybe some material support in some ways, depending on the length of the conflict. But I think NATO as a whole is far away, is consumed with other things closer in, would be concerned about moving military equipment that then Russia might take advantage of. I just don't see it at this stage.
Would any of our key NATO, the key NATO players, you know, Britain, France, Germany being a much longer shot?
I think that that there'd be various forms of support from those who have deeper interests and presence in the Pacific. Those include the Brits do have offshore patrol vessels and other longstanding engagements in the area. You know, the Canadians are also there with capabilities of French, of course, and most of Polynesia and the Oceania areas there. So I think you can expect a certain level of support if China decides to invade Taiwan. I don't think it would be necessarily direct military involvement, though.
What would be the South Korean reaction?
South Korea is like many other countries that are right there on the border with China and have heavy trade relations, has to play a tight wire act in terms of what they do. And so I think it depends on the administration that's in South Korea. And I think it depends on, you know, how you got into that flashpoint in the first place. So I can see some conditions where there would be a certain level of support there. But I think it all depends on the circumstances of how this thing started.
What about any of the countries that border the South China Sea, you know, the Philippines, Vietnam, Indonesia? Would those countries use this as an opportunity to push back farther, or would they do anything in their power to stay out of it?
Yeah, you know, with the Philippines, you know, we have been talking to them about enhanced defense cooperation, you know, sites and other things that relate to our mutual defense treaty with them. And so how that plays in a Taiwan scenario is unknown there, but it would be an important decision for the Philippine president and, you know, maybe a test of the mutual defense treaty. The other players like Vietnam and Malaysia, Indonesia, I do not see them necessarily interfering in any kind of combat operations, no.
Would they push back in the South China Sea to sort of, while the Chinese are distracted, try to shore up their own positions just locally?
I don't think that they would do so. I think they would be very circumspect about their choices. You know, they know that long after maybe the flames might die down from a particular crisis, that China will turn back and potentially penalize them in significant ways. So I think they'd be very circumspect and cautious that way.
And as the Chinese like to say, we're here forever. The United States may not be.
Well, I think actually they are there forever. We've long been a Pacific power. We have 5 of our 7 defense alliances are in the Western Pacific. We will always be a Pacific power, and we will always be in the Pacific. And our interests there are acute, and they are longstanding. So China will be there, and the United States will also be there.
What about India? You know, they're increasingly coming into the U.S. orbit, but I have not read anyone who predicts that they would get into a hot war with China over, especially over Taiwan. What would be their stance in, you know,
yeah,
in 2027, theoretically?
I wouldn't say they're coming into the U.S. orbit. I think that's strong language. And if there's an Indian official here, highly offended. I don't think it's accurate. I think, you know, states align when their interests converge, and the threat of China and what it potentially could do is scaring the bananas out of the world. And so the Indians are doing natural things that you do, and that is you get closer to folks who you have, you know, you share their views of the international order and the security environment and things like that. I don't see them intervening in those sorts of things, you know, but the Indians themselves are, you know, very concerned about what the Chinese growth may be for them in the long run. So yeah, we'll have to see how it all works out. And I say that because the extent to which Indians may exercise more with the U.S. and Australia and Japan and company, I think we'll end up perhaps seeing more activity slowly along those lines. It sort of makes sense. I just don't see that the Indians would really have a dog in the fight if it was over Taiwan.
The last player, and this comes with some assumptions that the Ukraine war is over and that Russia has not entered into a somewhat of a post-Soviet decline phase. What would Russia do? Like, what's their calculus on that?
Yeah, I mean, once again, these are million-dollar questions. I appreciate you asking them. But the Russians obviously have that special relationship, you know, thick as thieves, and I mean that directly. And I can see that a vengeful, spiteful, I don't care about my international reputation leader in Moscow would potentially be a spoiler, try to dilute U.S. force presence by doing, you know, patrols towards Hawaii or, you know, up in the Bering Sea or, you know, something that might try to take our forces away from another area where we want to concentrate them. You know, I can see them playing that game, maybe sharing intelligence and taking advantage of anything that can put more knocks in the United States and the West. I wouldn't put that past them.
So what are the interlinkages between China and Iran and Russia that cause the greatest national security and national economic security concerns?
Well, first of all, the fact that China can essentially succor Russia and alleviate the worst of the sanctions and give them essentially an outlet to still get some advanced technology, to be a place where they can buy their oil and energy, and essentially not face the full consequences of their invasion of Ukraine. Essentially, China's been a little bit of a buffer and, you know, a safety net for them. And so that's not helpful. And then, you know, if you're adding Iran into the mix, look, you know, the Iranian and Chinese relationship has deepened. China depends heavily on Iranian oil, and the Iranians providing weaponry, unmanned systems to the Russians. You know, a little cozy club there with some of these bad actors that essentially look at the international order and are okay with trying to change it to their advantage. And so they are allied against the West. And so you will see more cooperation between these countries. And the question on the economic front is whether or not you're going to end up with essentially blocks that are created where instead of like a globalized economy, essentially you've got subunits where you have people like the folks in Iran and Russia and China and other places essentially helping one another and being their own, like Shanghai cooperation, like in Central Asia, you know, whether or not China would love to have the BRICS there with South Africa and Brazil and India form kind of their own rule sets for economic advantage. How that goes is going to be very fascinating to watch. And I suspect we will have some floating blocks out there that will be in competition with one another, that will redefine that which we were trying to create, which is a globalized economy where really people were just trying to get the lowest possible price for the best goods, the high quality goods, and quickly moving through, you know, markets. That no longer, I think, that ideal is no longer realistic in the 21st century.
States will be somewhat more economically self-sufficient with themselves and their friends, but the average citizen of the world will probably be somewhat worse off for that.
I think you will see some protectionism. I think you will see everybody doing essentially friend shoring. Mm-hmm. And in their view, de-risking. If you're the Chinese, Russians, Iranian regime, you'd want to make sure that you're not so vulnerable to potential sanctions from the West, right? And that involves some amount of de-linking, some amount of inwardness, and greater amount of self-reliance and protectionism than before. And that's what we're seeing already in motion in different places around the world.
There's a lot of hope that since the 90s among American politicians and professionals and a lot of you in the military that engaging with China over the decades would lead them to adopt to international norms, right? Western international norms. And it's clear today that the Chinese leaders have said, no, thank you. We got the economic benefit. We don't want to play by your rules. What is an end state, in your opinion, that would see resolution to the rising tensions between China and the United States? And how, where's the Navy play into that? You know, a peaceful resolution.
Yeah, I think we're going to have to see some moderation of the Chinese views about how to achieve their rejuvenation. They, you know, lie, cheat, steal, and are using authoritarian practices. They've externalized propaganda. They're thieving intellectual property in a way that's been called the greatest transfer of wealth in history. If you continue to have a rule breaker do this at the scale that they're doing and poison the information sphere with their propaganda, and then with the increasing index of strength that they have comprehensively in their nation, with an increased willingness to use raw, naked influence and power to get their way, then you have a problem, Houston. And so the question is whether or not they would moderate the method by which they would like to attain their particular dream. If their dream is appropriated from everybody else's dream, if their dream comes at the price and expense of everybody else's rights as sovereign nations, then it would be very hard to keep the peace, because those sorts of trends historically bring nations into a clash. And so we have yet to see whether or not China is going to figure this out and figure a way to integrate in a way that still allows them to grow and be prosperous and to elevate their standard of living and not essentially do it on the backs of the rest of the international community and have it be a zero-sum game. So they think they're confident enough. They think they can do it. They want to be the number one power in the world, the strongest pole in a multipolar system. You know, nothing will stop them from getting there at this stage here. And so you ask, well, what can the United States do? I personally think that we can manage on the margins, but ultimately it's about what Xi Jinping wants to do and how hard he intends to push and by what means. He essentially wants to look out for China and move forward and essentially try to realize the Middle Kingdom again, with their state at the top of the hierarchy and everybody else being vassal states. That's the fundamental problem, a statement that you kind of raised there.
So I agree with what you said. That's largely my analysis as well. And my concern, and this sort of goes to the last question, and this is a question that I've thought a lot about with growing apprehension as time goes on, is that a fairly good analogy for a next Pacific war would be that the United States is to the Imperial Japanese Navy is to World War II, as the People's Liberation Army Navy is to the United States Navy to, you know, not necessarily World War III, but a next Pacific hot war. And in the sense that the United States had vastly more latent industrial capacity, the United States had a much larger shipbuilding industry, the United States had a much larger population and sort of more industrial resources with which to fight the war. That being said, the Japanese were better trained and had arguably some better technology and a strong starting position and did fantastically well for the first 6 months. But ultimately, we came down to a war of attrition where there was no hope. And to what extent is that an accurate analogy? And if not, why?
I think there are some loose parallels to what you described. I think that's one way of looking at the potential there for how a clash between major states would go. a lot of this depends on the will of the nation and the nation's leaders. It depends on who stands with who. And so, you know, the beauty of America is that we have a lot of alliances, a lot of partners, a lot of friends that will stand with us because they know we're standing up for an international order that they've benefited from. And they believe in freedom and liberty and the and rights and laws that should be guides to the way that international commerce works. We have a lot of people out there that, in fact, would support in a crisis or in a conflict in one way or another. China doesn't have that. You know, China has very testy relationships, even with some of its closest partners, but it would be alone in this particular instance. And so who's to say in a protracted conflict how things would work out? But when I say that allies can make all the difference, friends can make all the difference, imagine if you pool together the industrial capacity of everybody the United States is friends with. And let's take a look at how that would match up against China alone, right? So you can speculate along these lines, but I just tell you that nobody can foresee the future, but there are a lot of options that could be played as people think about counterbalancing China in peacetime and dealing with it if they so choose to essentially, you know, nakedly use combat arms.
More food for thought. Not the parallel I hope for, certainly, but it's a, you know, one, I don't know, sort of as we talked about nations that would or would not be willing to intervene and, you know, to the extent they may or may not give us, you know, their spare industrial capacity or switch over their industry to military spending. Yeah, it's, I don't know. I sincerely hope that we never have to find out. And I don't think that it will be as cut and dry as Japan versus the United States. There's not a, it's not that large of a imbalance. And in many ways, we hold a lot of advantages over China. And I hope that we continue to do so forever.
Yeah, look, a war would be devastating to not just China and Russia or China, US and, you know, Taiwan. A war would be devastating to the planet.
Yeah.
And it would be such a violation of some of the existing relationships that China is the aggressor, I don't think would recover. I don't think the CCP and Xi Jinping would survive. I think the amount of international backlash between the strongest powers in the international system would ultimately pay such a, have him pay such a high a price. You know, you're talking about people that may have, you know, pre-crisis been willing to sign contracts or allow this or that and the other. Post-crisis, the entire optic on China and what it really stands for and what it's really prepared to do to crush freedom and democracy and liberty would be laid bare for the entire world to see. Some global South people are already overleveraged and they won't care. They'll just stay quiet. But many of the people in the world that are taking a look at this are not going to be cooperating with a post-aggressive China here. The Chinese economy would tank and the CCP would be held accountable for essentially destroying all the hard-won gains in building China's economy up to where it is today and where it could go if it is able to manage the peace.
And that's, you know, the problem when you have unaccountable systems of government, and especially when it's concentrated on one person, that one person may have different goals, or, you know, we'll use Xi Jinping, right? His goal may be to, you know, go down the history books as the person who restored Chinese greatness. And I mean, no point wait until you're 90. You don't get to enjoy it that way, right? Better to do it before you're dead. And, you know, same thing with Russia, right? You know, someone, you know, Putin could very well, part of this calculus is legacy building. And, you know, I want to make sure that I am remembered well. And how do you get remembered well? Well, territory is a great way. And, you know, as opposed to taking what would seem like the much more, the longer term route to economic prosperity, China's on a great path. It doesn't seem like it's going to end anytime soon, but that path may not come to fruition prior to Xi Jinping being too old to enjoy it or dead.
Yeah. You know, when I take a look at Chinese leaders, you know, for all of the problematic things that Deng Xiaoping was involved in, including the Tiananmen Square massacre in 1989, the one area where he had wisdom was to say on solving Taiwan that that can wait 100 years, right, mm-hmm. or more. And then you got a guy that's impatient like Xi Jinping, and he is ready to wreck his country and the reputation of the CCP. You know, if things don't go well, and the likelihood is that it will not go well for China. And he's driving his country to be more rabid about solving the Taiwan political situation here when you don't have to. Status quo is good enough. We're not recognizing Taiwan as an independent nation. We're not doing it. They're not an independent nation. But they are a democracy and they are their own government. And for now, that's probably good enough there. So Xi Jinping has the controls in his hands. And what scares everybody is that he, unlike a Deng Xiaoping who had the wisdom to see that time may not be ripe, he may choose to act in a way that would be very self-destructive. And so we hope that he actually maintains sound mind and thoughts on this, but he says a lot of things that suggest that we're in more dangerous territory on this. But these are the conversations that we need to have more of across the United States. We really need a conversation with the country about not just the dangers of China as it relates to a flashpoint like Taiwan, but there's so many more dangers about what China represents across the wider front and in every sector, whether you're talking mm-hmm. the domain, our economy, our technological edge, our innovation capabilities, even like things like police stations that the Chinese were able to set up in New York, whatever. I mean, the Chinese problem goes well beyond the Taiwan issue. And we have to recognize that for what it is, which requires us to really connect the dots and have a larger conversation about how all these things are connected. So maybe for a future podcast, I don't know.
Yeah, the whole extraterritorial aspect of Chinese justice or injustice, I suppose, is not good. Yeah, so thank you very much, sir. It was a pleasure having you there with me and people that will be listening. Everything that you are able to contribute. Again, this is Rear Admiral Mike Sudeman, and thank you, sir.
So thank you very much for listening to the U.S. Naval History Podcast. It has been a lot of fun to produce this South China Sea miniseries, which I think is a very important topic. Hopefully you found it somewhat interesting, at least. If you did, please give me 5 stars on Spotify, iTunes, wherever else you're listening. Write a review. Send me an email, usnavalhistorypodcast@gmail.com. I love getting emails from people, and I respond to all of them. And until next time, fair winds and following seas.